Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today the theme is real versus phony, including a reading from the classic essay, Escaping the Matrix. I hope you'll stay tuned. Here are some things I learned this summer. You can eat radish leaves. Toss them into your salad. They taste like arugula. You can also eat broccoli leaves. Toss them into your salad. They also taste like arugula. Also, fresh broccoli stalks have a lovely, slightly sweet taste. I don't mean agribusiness supermarket broccoli. I mean organic broccoli from a small farm, eaten just a couple hours after it was picked. Who knew? By this point, everybody knows that if you want a tasty tomato, don't go anywhere near a supermarket. Grow it yourself or find a farm stand. Corn on the cob, likewise. I learned that years ago. Then, just 2 years ago, I had another revelation. Fresh garlic. Fresh local garlic is twice as moist and three times as flavorful as the hard, mass-produced garlic in the supermarket. In Connecticut, fresh garlic is harder to find than corn or tomatoes. Check out the weekly farmers markets. Fold up the heads of garlic in a paper bag, and they'll keep for maybe 4 or 5 months. That's enough to get you through most of the winter. It was through their garlic that I discovered Tom and Sherry's organic farm. That was just 1 year ago. Tom focuses on the agriculture proper and farm maintenance. Sherry manages the farm's retail store, CSA operation, and the sugar house. Numerous children help out. Anyway, the farm is a lovely place, run by lovely people, with produce that keeps surprising me. I mean, broccoli stalks that actually taste good? Radishes with stems attached and with leaves that taste like arugula? Carrots without any bitterness at all? Why was I never informed that these things exist? Oh, brave new world that has such wonders in it! The farm is near the border of Bolton, Hebron, and Andover, Connecticut. That's Nowheresville to my sophisticated friends in West Hartford. Be that as it may, it's a beautiful 10-mile, mostly rural, bicycle ride from my door to their farm. 20 miles round trip. Bicycling is the poor man's psychotherapy, and 20 miles is just enough to be therapeutic. 30 miles is better still, so I usually take a roundabout route. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot drawing near. Soon the fresh produce will cease, except for squash. Then winter will set in. Bicycle therapy will get cut way back. My outlook on life, which is plenty dark already, will darken further. My stockpile of local garlic will dwindle and decay. I'll be reduced to eating supermarket vegetables, and probably quoting Shakespeare. From hour to hour we ripe and ripe, and hour to hour we rot and rot, and thereby hangs a tale. But for now, it's gather ye radishes while ye may. Time to squirt some oil on the bicycle chain and head for the countryside. Let the yuppies get all excited about their new solar-powered personal fitness monitor, or their new, improved, internet-connected smart thermostat that automatically makes your house 3 degrees warmer because it knows from reading your email that Aunt Ethel is coming for a visit. Thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to pedal out to the country and see if those long, skinny eggplants are worth eating. And if the leeks have come in yet, and if broccoli is still available. I'll let you know when I get back.
The design of the galaxy is in the soil. Patterns are there, all very near. Look down, wisdom abounds. Soil grows the seed, bursts the flower, courts the bee, makes the honey. Honey is free. Soil anchors tree, hosts the nest, cradles the bird, offers song. Song is free. Honey we relish, bird song we cherish, and soil we must revere. The design of the heavens quite near. Soil holds the seed, grows the plant, feeds the body, lifts the breath. Breath is free. Soil houses life, fuels the web, awakens heart, stirs the dance. Dance is free. Breath we do cherish, dancing we relish, and soil we must revere. The design of the galaxy is in the soil.
Time to shift gears a bit, though we'll stay on the subject of real versus phony. Remember the movie The Matrix? After the first reel, it declined into a kind of trite science fiction action flick, but it started off great. A normal 20-something guy named Neo is given the option to take a blue pill or a red pill. The blue pill returns him to his familiar world. However, this world is actually a fake, an engineered fantasy. It is the Matrix, and he's been stuck inside it. The red pill lets him escape the Matrix and discover the real world as it actually exists. This real world is a lot less pleasant than the Matrix world. Neo takes the red pill, and off we go. It's a great premise, an updated version of Plato's famous cave allegory. The movie inspired a very nice essay by a chap named Richard K. Moore in the year 2000. Moore contrasts the establishment's phony account of how the world works with how the world actually works. The propaganda versus the reality. Say, the aim of U.S. foreign policy is to promote democracy and to secure peace worldwide. That's the Matrix version, the version that the powers that be want you to believe. Bust out of the Matrix, and you can see that the real goal of U.S. foreign policy is to further empower and enrich the Rockefellers and such. And democracy be damned. The essayist, Richard Moore, clearly is on the same wavelength as Noam Chomsky, Michael Parenti, and some other folks often heard on New World Notes. This week and next, we'll hear Moore's words, read by Lynn Gurry. Lynn was the founder and longtime host of the radio program Unwelcome Guests. Her reading is from January 2002. Nearly two decades after it was published, Richard Moore's essay still rings true. Here is part one of Escaping the Matrix.
Moore begins the article by asking, "Are you ready for the red pill?" The defining dramatic moment in the film The Matrix occurs just after Morpheus invites Neo to choose between a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill promises the truth, nothing more. Neo takes the red pill and awakes to reality, something utterly different from anything Neo or the audience could have expected. What Neo had assumed to be reality turned out to be only a collective illusion, fabricated by the Matrix and fed to a population that is asleep, cocooned in grotesque embryonic pods. In Plato's famous parable about the shadows on the walls of the cave, True reality is at least reflected in perceived reality. In the matrix world, true reality and perceived reality exist on entirely different planes. The story is intended as a metaphor, and the parallels that drew my attention had to do with political reality. This article offers a particular perspective on what's going on in the world and how things got to be that way in this era of globalization. From that red pill perspective, everyday media consensus reality, like the Matrix in the film, is seen to be a fabricated collective illusion. Like Neo, I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began, but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense. I read scores of histories and biographies, observing connections between them, and began to develop my own theories about roots of various historical events. I found myself largely in agreement with writers like Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, but I also perceived important patterns that others seemed to have missed. When I started tracing historical forces and began to interpret present-day events from a historical perspective, I could see the same old dynamics at work and found a meaning in the unfolding events far different from what official pronouncements proclaimed. Such pronouncements are, after all, public relations fare given out by politicians who want to look good to the voters. Most of us expect rhetoric from politicians and take what they say with a grain of salt. But as my own picture of present reality came into focus, grain of salt no longer worked as a metaphor. I began to see that consensus reality, as generated by official rhetoric and amplified by mass media, bears very little relationship to actual reality. The Matrix was a metaphor I was ready for. In consensus reality, the blue pill perspective, left and right are two ends of the political spectrum. Politics is a tug of war between competing factions carried out by political parties and elected representatives. Society gets pulled this way and that within the political spectrum, reflecting the interests of whichever party won the last election. The left and right are therefore political enemies. Each side is convinced that it knows how to make society better. Each believes the other enjoys undue influence, and each blames the other for the political stalemate that apparently prevents society from dealing effectively with its problems. This perspective on the political process, and on the roles of left and right, is very far from reality. It is a fabricated collective illusion. Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is the world that was pulled over your eyes to hide you from the truth. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. Consensus political reality is precisely such a matrix. Later, we'll take a fresh look at the role of left and right and at national politics. But first, we must develop our red pill historical perspective. I've had to condense the arguments to bare essentials. Please see the annotated sources at the end for more thorough treatments of particular topics. Imperialism and the Matrix. From the time of Columbus to 1945, world affairs were largely dominated by competition among Western nations seeking to stake out spheres of influence, control sea lanes, and exploit colonial empires. Each Western power became the core of an imperialist economy whose periphery was managed for the benefit of the core nation. Military might determined the scope of an empire. Wars were initiated when a core nation felt it had sufficient power to expand its periphery at the expense of a competitor. Economies and societies in the periphery were kept backward to keep their populations under control, to provide cheap labor, and to guarantee markets for goods manufactured at the core. Imperialism robbed the periphery not only of wealth, but also of its ability to develop its own societies, cultures, and economies in a natural way for local benefit. The driving force behind Western imperialism has always been the pursuit of economic gain, ever since Isabella commissioned Columbus on his first entrepreneurial voyage. The rhetoric of empire concerning wars, however, has typically been about other things. The white man's burden, bringing true religion to the heathens, manifest destiny, defeating the yellow peril or the Hun, seeking Laban's realm or making the world safe for democracy. Any fabricated motivation for war or empire would do as long as it appealed to the collective consciousness of the population at the time. The propaganda lies of yesterday were recorded and became consensus history, the fabric of the Matrix. While the costs of territorial empire, fleets, colonial administrations, etc., were borne by Western taxpayers generally, the profits of imperialism were enjoyed primarily by private corporations and investors. Government and corporate elites were partners in the business of imperialism. Empires gave government leaders power and prestige, and gave corporate leaders power and wealth. Corporations ran the real business of empire while government leaders fabricated noble excuses for the wars that were required to keep that business going. Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics. Industrialization, beginning in the late 1700s, created a demand for new markets and increased raw materials. Both demands spurred accelerated expansion of empire. Wealthy investors amassed fortunes by setting up large-scale industrial and trading operations, leading to the emergence of an influential capitalist elite. Like any other elite, capitalists used their wealth and influence to further their own interests however they could. And the interests of capitalism always come down to economic growth. Investors must reap more than they sow, or the whole system comes to a grinding halt. Thus, capitalism, industrialization, nationalism, warfare, imperialism, and the Matrix co-evolved. Industrialized weapon production provided the muscle of modern warfare, and capitalism provided the appetite to use that muscle. Government leaders pursued the politics necessary to expand empire while creating a rhetorical matrix around nationalism to justify those policies. Capitalist growth depended on empire, which in turn depended on a strong and stable core nation to defend it. National interests and capitalist interests were inextricably linked, or so it seemed, for more than two centuries. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Continuing. World War II and Pax Americana. 1945 will be remembered as a year World War II ended and the bond of the atomic nucleus was broken. But 1945 also marked another momentous fission, the breaking of the bond between national and capitalist interests. After every previous war, and in many cases after severe devastation, European nations had always picked themselves back up and resumed their competition over empire. But after World War II, a Pax Americana was established. The U.S. began to manage all the Western peripheries on behalf of capitalism generally, while preventing the communist powers from interfering in the game. Capitalist powers no longer needed to fight over investment realms, and competitive imperialism was replaced by collective imperialism. Opportunities for capital growth were no longer linked to the military power of nations apart from the power of America. In his Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, William Blum chronicles hundreds of significant covert and overt interventions, showing exactly how the U.S. carried out its imperial management role. In the post-war years, Matrix reality diverged ever further from actual reality. In the post-war Matrix world, imperialism had been abandoned and the world was being, quote, democratized. In the real world, imperialism had become better organized and more efficient. In the Matrix world, the U.S., quote, restored order or, quote, came to the assistance of nations which were being, quote, undermined by Soviet influence, unquote. In the real world, the periphery was being systematically suppressed and exploited. In the Matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery. Growing glitches in the matrix weren't noticed by most people in the West because the post-war years brought unprecedented levels of Western prosperity and social progress. The rhetoric claimed progress would come to all, and Westerners could see it being realized in their own towns and cities. The West became the collective core of a global empire, and exploitative development led to prosperity for Western populations, while generating immense riches for corporations, banks, and wealthy capital investors. Glitches in the Matrix, Popular Rebellion, and Neoliberalism. The parallel agenda of third world exploitation and Western prosperity worked effectively for the first two post-war decades. But in the 1960s, large numbers of Westerners, particularly the young and well-educated, began to notice glitches in the matrix. In Vietnam, imperialism was too naked to be successfully masked as something else. A major split in American public consciousness occurred as millions of anti-war protesters and civil rights activists punctured the fabricated consensus of the 1950s and declared the reality of exploitation and suppression, both at home and abroad. The environmental movement arose, challenging even the exploitation of the natural world. In Europe, 1968 joined 1848 as a landmark year of popular protest. These developments disturbed elite planners. The post-war regime's stability was being challenged from within the core, and the formula of Western prosperity no longer guaranteed public passivity. A report published in 1975, the report of the Trilateral Task Force on Governability of Democracies, provides a glimpse into the thinking of elite circles. Alan Wolfe discusses this report in Holly Sklar's eye-opening work, Trilateralism. Wolfe focuses especially on the analysis Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington presented in a section of the report entitled The Crisis of Democracy. Huntington is an articulate promoter of elite policy shifts and contributes pivotal articles to publications such as the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. Huntington tells us that democratic societies cannot work, quote-unquote, unless the citizenry is, quote, passive. The, quote, democratic surge of the 1960s represented an, quote, excess of democracy, which must be reduced if governments are to carry out their traditional domestic and foreign policies. Huntington's notion of traditional policies is expressed in a passage from the report, quote, "To the extent that the United States was governed by anyone during the decades after World War II, it was governed by the president, acting with the support and cooperation of key individuals and groups in the executive office, the federal bureaucracy, Congress, and the more important businesses, banks, law firms, foundations, and media, which constitute the private sector's establishment." Close quote. In these few words, Huntington spells out the reality that electoral democracy has little to do with how America is run, and summarizes the kind of people who are included within the elite planning community. Who needs conspiracy theories when elite machinations are clearly described in public documents like these? Besides failing to deliver popular passivity, the policy of prosperity for Western populations had another downside, having to do with Japan's economic success. Under the Pax Americana umbrella, Japan had been able to industrialize and become an imperial player. The prohibition on Japanese rearmament had become irrelevant. With Japan's then lower living standards, Japanese producers could undercut prevailing prices and steal market share from Western producers. Western capital needed to find a way to become more competitive on world markets, and Western prosperity was standing in the way. Elite strategists, as Huntington showed, were fully capable of understanding these considerations, and the requirements of corporate growth created a strong motivation to make the needed adjustments in both reality and rhetoric. If popular prosperity could be sacrificed, there were many obvious ways Western capital could be made more competitive. Production could be moved overseas to low-wage areas, allowing domestic unemployment to rise. Unions could be attacked and wages forced down, and people could be pushed into temporary and part-time jobs without benefits. Regulations governing corporate behavior could be removed. Corporate and capital gains taxes could be reduced, and the revenue losses could be taken out of public service budgets. Public infrastructures could be privatized, the services reduced to cut costs, and then they could be milked for easy profits when they deteriorated from neglect. These are the very policies and programs launched during the Reagan-Thatcher years in the U.S. and Britain. They represent a systematic project of increasing corporate growth at the expense of popular prosperity and welfare. Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization, but around them was woven an economic mythology. The old, failed, laissez-faire doctrine of the 1800s was reintroduced with the help of Milton Friedman's Chicago School of Economics, and less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain. Sensible regulations had restored financial stability after the Great Depression, and had broken up anti-competitive monopolies such as the Rockefeller Trust and AT&T. But in the new matrix reality, all regulations were considered bureaucratic interference. Reagan and Thatcher preached the virtues of individualism and promised to, quote, get government off people's backs, unquote. The implication was that everyday individuals were to get more money and freedom, but in reality, the primary benefits would go to corporations and wealthy investors. The academic term for laissez-faire economics is economic liberalism, and hence the Reagan-Thatcher revolution has come to be known as the neoliberal revolution. It brought a radical change in actual reality by returning to the economic philosophy that led to sweatshops, corruption, and robber baron monopolies in the 19th century. It brought an equally radical change in matrix reality, a complete reversal in the attitude that was projected regarding government. Government policies had always been criticized in the media, but the institution of government had always been respected, reflecting the traditional bond between capitalism and nationalism. With Reagan, we had a sitting president telling us that government itself was a bad thing. Many of us may have agreed with him, but such a sentiment had never before found official favor. Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process.
Lynn Gary, reading Richard K. Moore's classic essay, Escaping the Matrix. We'll hear the rest next week. You've been listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, bidding illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.